Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. U.S. ally Saudi Arabia is back in the news because of the monarchy's largest mass execution in decades. Last Saturday, Saudi Arabia executed 47 people, including the well-known Shia cleric Nimr al-Nimr. Human rights organizations condemned the execution. Amnesty International said the Saudi regime is using the death penalty in the name of counter-terror to settle scores and crush dissidents, sentencing activists to death after grossly unfair trials. Amnesty is calling this a monstrous and irreversible injustice. After the executions, protesters in Iran ransacked Saudi embassies in Tehran. In response to the attacks, Saudi Arabia severed all diplomatic and commercial ties with Iran. So how are the media reporting on the U.S.-Saudi relationship? This is getting a lot of media attention. And what about the diplomatic crisis between Iran and Saudi Arabia? Now that so much has been written about this and we've heard a lot of discussions, do you have a good understanding of what's actually happening and why this happened to begin with? Joining us to discuss media coverage is Borzu Daragahi, Middle East correspondent for BuzzFeed, based in Istanbul, Turkey. Borzu is the former Baghdad bureau chief for the LA Times. Hi, Borzu. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
Nice to have you back. We're also joined by Lee Feng, an investigative reporter with The Intercept. One of Lee's latest pieces is about Saudi Arabia's public relations campaign to shape how the news is covered. He reports that in many cases, the American media quotes pundits justifying the executions in Saudi Arabia without mentioning their funding or close affiliation with the Saudi government. And Lee Feng joins me here in studio. Hi, Lee. Nice to see you.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming in. So as we always do on Your Calls Media Roundtable, we start off on a positive note and highlight good journalism. So Borzu Daragahi, let's start off with you. What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
It's really funny, actually. I was going to mention actually Lee's story that you brought up. I didn't know he was going to be on the show, but then when I found out Lee was going to be on the show, I scrambled to sort of my memory to find the other high impact story I saw this week, and I guess it would have to be Karim Shaheen of the Guardian's report on the siege of Madaya, a suburb of Damascus, under a sort of blockade by the regime, and these sort of harrowing images of people basically starving to death inside this area that is blockaded by the Syrian troops. No food is allowed in, no aid is allowed in. I thought it was really important that this story got out. There's been rumors of this happening, of this sort of tactic of war being imposed on this community. But until these pictures came out, these images came out, these interviews came out this week, there was really no idea of just the sheer horror of what's going on there and the shame of the international community that allows this to go on with not even so much as a slap on the wrist for Bashar al-Assad.
And Borzu, I read that Syria's government gave permission for UN aid deliveries to three towns, including Madaya.
Exactly. I think it was as a result of this report and our report and the New York Times report, as a result of these images coming out of Madaya, that the impact of these images, that the Bashar regime relented. And allowed a little bit of aid to go into these areas, as the UN and other aid organizations have been begging for months.
Your colleagues spoke with some residents. What are they hearing? And then also, what is it like to actually report from inside Syria? Is it possible to get in, or are you relying on social media?
I wouldn't say that we rely on social media. It's not possible to go to that part of Damascus unless you're embedded with the regime and they let you go to certain parts of Syria and they see what you see what they want you to see. It is possible to go to a tiny sliver of northern Syria under the control of the Kurds right now. And my colleague Mike Giglio goes there every now and then. But what we do is we rely first and foremost in reporting on a story like this on trusted contacts there, and then we corroborate. We talk to aid agencies, Western aid agencies that operate inside Syria, and we ask at this point in Syria, I don't trust anything unless I see pictures and video as well.
All right. So kudos to Karim Shaheen with The Guardian for writing about the siege of Medea. And we will put a link to that at yourcallradio.org. And then also on Tuesday, we did a show with Professor Samer Aboud, who's out with a new book called Syria. And we talked about what's happening inside of Syria. You can find that show at yourcallradio.org. And also kudos to you, Li Feng. It's funny that Borzu was going to bring up your piece, which we'll talk about on today's show. But what did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Yeah, thank you so much, Borzu. I really appreciate that. I'm humbled. You know, there was a lot of good journalism this week, but I want to give a hat tip to my colleague, Glenn Greenwald. He did kind of like an opinion piece that I think is really important this week. So many kind of think pieces this week and news on the anniversary of the Charlie Hebdo attacks. And Greenwald, today, actually this morning, he posted it earlier this morning, has an article that takes a look at the folks who, after those attacks, you know, came together in a big kumbaya moment and said, we got to stand up for individual liberty, for freedom of expression. But where have those people been in the last year where freedom of expression and free speech has been under attack when it comes to Muslims living in France? You know, France, after these attacks and after the Paris attacks, instituted emergency powers, giving the police power to raid people's homes without a warrant, shutting down cafes and places and mosques where people come together, basically with no legal justification, new surveillance powers to spy on people. This was supposed to be an emergency power for 2 weeks and then expanded to 3 months. And now it looks like the French are moving to make these powers basically permanent. But where is this, we had that kumbaya moment a year ago where people were talking about freedom of speech, but when freedom of speech is now under attack when it comes to Muslims and living in France, it's basically silence in the international community. And now we're actually seeing that those expanded surveillance and police powers are being used not just on Muslims in France, but they were used also to raid and suppress climate activists who are coming together in Paris recently. So these police powers are expanding rapidly, and it's controversial.
I think I heard the editor of a newspaper in Paris say that there's a lot of different opinions about that in France, but she said most people are in favor of obviously protecting their right to free speech.
Sure, at least in the American media, and we haven't seen the kind of robust demand for individual liberty, and it is more complicated in France. But I remember a year ago today, you saw so many pundits on TV talking about the importance of free speech and individual liberty. Where are they today? Where is it on CNN? Where is it on in the national media?
All right, so kudos to Glenn Greenwald at The Intercept for writing about this, and you can find these stories at yourcallradio.org. Li Feng is an investigative reporter with The Intercept, and Borzu Daragahi is Middle East correspondent for BuzzFeed News based in Istanbul, Turkey. So let's talk about what's happening in Saudi Arabia. And Borzu, the executions are getting so much attention in the media. Last Saturday, Saudi Arabia executed 47 people, including the well-known Shia cleric Nimr al-Nimr. But based on what I've seen, what's missing from a lot of the coverage is who else was executed, first of all? 47 people, that's a lot of people. Have you seen much coverage of that? Who else was executed besides this Shia cleric?
Well, I mean, I can't say that I've seen too much or too little coverage of that, but I mean, I know who else was executed. There was three other Shia activists, and the rest were all alleged members of extremist groups who were not Shia, who were Sunni, who had been accused of various security crimes, mostly dating back to the last decade, sort of pre-Arab Spring jihadis who had been on death row for years and years and were finally dealt with as far as the Saudi regime is concerned. So in terms of who they were, that's who they were.
And why is the Shia cleric and Nimr al-Nimr getting so much attention?
I think what was stunning about the execution of Nimr al-Nimr, first of all, you know, he's, you know, known to the international community. You know, there's like several WikiLeaks documents in which U.S. diplomats in Saudi Arabia are meeting with this guy and chatting with him. He was sort of known as an opposition figure. And he was also sort of an Arab Spring figure in Saudi Arabia, calling for peaceful protests mostly, calling for, you know, sort of vigilant but peaceful protests. And out in the streets, he was accused of riling up and inciting people to violence. But no evidence has emerged of that. As a matter of fact, every single speech that you listen to him talk, and I've been like listening to a lot of his speeches over the last week or so, you know, he's really fiery. He's really insulting. He says some really nasty, rude things about the Saudi monarchy. But he's, you know, it's obvious what mold he's in. And he's definitely in the mold of more of a sort of human rights activist, firebrand, preacher, calling for people to get out in the streets and protest and demand their rights than someone who's calling for guys to set IEDs on roads or launch rockets at convoys or something like that. That wasn't his style at all. So I think that just stunned people. You don't execute a guy like that, not even in the Middle East, you know. You hold him in prison for a long time as a bargaining chip.
So the other thing that I haven't been reading much about is what explains Saudi Arabia's decision to execute such a prominent person?
I mean, there's a lot of explanations out there and theories. You know, the Saudi leadership is remarkably opaque. Maybe they wanted to send a message to Iran, where this guy had patrons, where he had studied as a cleric for many years. Maybe they wanted to provoke Iran. I've heard that. I don't think that's convincing. I actually appreciate the theory more that they wanted to execute the Sunni guys, but they didn't want that because there's so many people in the kingdom who are sympathetic to them. They threw in a few Shia to sort of as a salve to the Sunnis who supported the jihadi guys. I mean, that might sound like trite, but you know, I mean, we're not talking about deep strategic thinkers here, you know. I think that, you know, there's like a group of maybe five or six guys who are making these decisions, and maybe they're not thinking so smartly and long-term and so on. They're just thinking that they're really smart and they have no one to tell them, you know, that's a really bad move.
Hmm. And Lee, this has been getting so much attention in the U.S. media. Do you think that there's a good understanding of why this happened and why it's getting so much attention?
Well, look, I mean, this has dominated the news this week, and we've seen a number of stories trying to explain it because, you know, this is shocking to so many Americans who might not have been following this, and even for folks who have been. You know, the New York Times had a big piece that was talked about this week saying, well, hey, by the way, there is this rivalry between Saudi Arabia and Iran, and it comes from the split in Islam dating back centuries ago between Shia and Sunni. And that got a lot of attention, you know, and that's certainly a big element of this. I mean, Saudi Arabia is considered, you know, the keeper of Sunni Islam, of a certain kind of strain of Sunni Islam that's much more conservative. Iran is the greatest kind of Shiite power. My colleague John Schwartz had a really interesting kind of commentary on that New York Times piece the following day or two. I think it came out maybe yesterday, by some kind of sheer coincidence, some kind of cosmic reason. You know, if you look at a map, and he has a map from a military professor, just complete coincidence, but if you look at where the largest deposits of oil are in the Middle East, they happen to be under Shia communities. And in fact, in Saudi Arabia, you know, about 15% of the population is Shia, and there's a lot of discrimination against this population. Sheikh Namir al-Namir, you know, lived in this eastern province where basically all the Shia live. The Shia live on top of where all the Saudi oil deposits are. If they didn't have that province, Saudi Arabia would be a destitute country. So, you know, there's been fears for decades, and you see that this in the WikiLeaks documents, in like the historical record, that Saudi Arabia has for a very long time been concerned that the Arab Spring, that Shia revolutions, whether it's in Iran or in other places, that they will inspire their own population in eastern Saudi Arabia to rise up and separate. And if they did that, they would control all of their oil. And as I mentioned, Saudi Arabia would be powerless. Mm-hmm. So there's this growing concern that Shia nationalism, whether it's instigated by Iran or not, will destabilize the mother's milk of Saudi Arabia, which is oil.
Borzu, what are your thoughts on that?
That's the part that's really confusing and confounding about this, is that, you know, I mean, Saudi's not a poor country. They have all this, all these resources. You are in this sensitive position where your minority is where most of the oil is. Why light this fire? You know, why not just buy them off? Better yet, why not give them a little bit of, you know, privileges and rights that the other Saudis have? You know, right now, Shia are 15% of Saudi, as Lee noted, and there's not a single cabinet minister who is a Shia. According to one person I talked to, there's not even a single high school principal in the country that's a Shia. So why not, you know, sort of deal them in just a little bit instead of doing this kind of provocative thing? This is the thing that was really baffling about this move.
And what about the framing of this, Borzu, the rivalry between Iran and the United States? How do you think reporters should unpack this relationship? And because you write for BuzzFeed, how do you go about reporting on this for an American audience?
Well, I mean, I you know, remember a time, I'm kind of old enough, when no one even in the Middle East even really knew that they were, very few people were cognizant of the fact that they were Sunni or Shia or Alawite or you know, Ibadi, all the various schools of Islam. This is a recent thing, this sort of flaring up of these sectarian identities. It started after the U.S. invasion of Iraq and the sort of sectarian tensions that arose as a result of it. And so I do not refer to the 1,400-year split between Sunni and Shia, except maybe in passing in describing what the two sects mean. This is about geopolitics. It's about oil. Mm-hmm. It's about who's the biggest kid on the block, you know. Just to give you one example, you know, Iran is a Shia power. Its biggest partner in the Caucasus is Armenia, which is a Christian government, whereas it has a hostile relationship with Azerbaijan, which is predominantly Shia. You know, so it's about pipeline routes and, you know, who is going to dominate which country and who is going to influence which part of the Middle East and so on, and changing balances of power. I think the sectarian thing and the sectarian identity is just a tool used by politicians and lazy analysts.
Hmm. Borzu Dargahi is a Middle East correspondent for BuzzFeed News. He's based in Istanbul. And Li Fang is an investigative reporter with The Intercept. And we're talking about media coverage of the executions last Saturday in Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia executed 47 people, and protesters ransacked Saudi embassies in Tehran. And in response to these attacks, Saudi Arabia severed diplomatic and commercial ties with Iran. This has been getting a lot of media attention this week. What do you think of the reporting? Do you now have a good understanding of why this is happening? Have you been reading about geopolitics and oil, or is it basically framed through a sectarian prism of Sunni versus Shia, which is what we saw in the New York Times? And then The Economist and the Financial Times have also published articles about the Sunni-Shia divide. What are your thoughts on the media coverage? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Lee, you've got a piece in The Intercept that follows the money and looks at how Saudi Arabia is trying to influence the news that we get here in the U.S. And Saudi Arabia has been in the news more because of its dismal human rights record, its key role in the region. Talk about how you followed the money to find out which PR firms Saudi Arabia has hired to get good coverage in the U.S.
Well, look, American lobbying and public relations kind of disclosure is very dismal in general. But starting actually in the 1930s, when the Nazis were coming here and actually trying to fund kind of neo-fascist or actually traditional fascist movements to discourage the U.S. from entering the war against them, there is kind of a big investigation and a law called the Foreign Agent Registration Act. And since then, it has weak enforcement, but it's a fairly strong law that actually requires foreign governments to go to the Department of Justice and register when they hire lobbying firms and public relations firms. So, you know, my last couple trips to D.C. for reporting, I've been going to the DOJ and getting some of these documents. In addition, I've been going to a lot of the think tanks in Washington and the other kind of political groups that, that usually weigh in on these types of debates, and going to their events and talking to people. And I put together a series, I think it's about five or six pieces, looking at the huge buildup for Saudi Arabia and investing in American lobbyists and American public relations experts and basically kind of campaign style tactics that you usually see, like coal companies or, you know, Wall Street companies hire, engaging in this form of like really sophisticated public relations manufacturing when it comes to domestic debates. But Saudi Arabia has really taken a lead in terms of doing their own kind of political influence machine.
You report that pundits are quoted in the United States media justifying the executions, and in many cases, there's no mention of their funding or their close affiliation with the Saudi Arabian government. Can you give us an example?
Sure. You know, about a year and a half ago, as part of this buildup in PR, the Saudi Arabia and the UAE funded a new think tank, the Arab States Gulf Institute, I believe. And this is 100% funded by the Saudi embassy and the UAE embassy. And this group has just a small stable of pundits who have been going on TV, who have been quoted in the Wall Street Journal and the Washington Post and Politico, who have been getting op-eds in the New York Times. And, you know, they're praising the relationship between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia. This week, of course, immediately these people are getting quoted, essentially justifying the executions that happened last Sunday. And, you know, for regular readers, when they read Arab States Gulf Institute, you know, they don't know what that is. They don't know that's funded and basically controlled by the Saudi embassy. So that's kind of necessary disclosure when we have these sorts of debates, especially in the media.
And you also report that Saudi Arabia's lobbyists, including Corvus and Targeted Victory, it's a social media company founded by Republican strategists.
Yeah, you know, Corvus is a big public relations firm that represents, you know, regimes all across the world. They were hired by Saudi Arabia after the September 11th attacks. But they've helped coordinate Saudi Arabia's influence machine, and Saudi Arabia has been, if you look at the filings, have been pumping millions and millions of dollars, much more so than they have years ago, but just in the last 2 years, in expanding this network. And so one of the firms they brought on last year is Targeted Victory. This is a firm founded by Mitt Romney's former digital team. These are the people that go out and create kind of like astroturfed tweets and infographics, and they kind of spoof all kinds of online ads to make people think that there's kind of like a grassroots movement in one direction. And they also do a lot of social media monitoring, so they know what the conversation is. These are, like, again, presidential tactics that are being applied in just a different setting. Actually Targeted Victory, these Mitt Romney folks who are now working for Saudi Arabia, they launched actually their own news channel, online social media news channel, last summer, called, I believe, Arabia Now. And, you know, it's all these, you know, it's about how Saudi Arabia is actually helping Yemen and sending humanitarian support to Yemen, even though we all know that there's a blockade preventing humanitarian assistance. This week, of course, that same Arabia Now media outlet that was started by these lobbyists, they were tweeting infographics saying Sheikh Namir al-Namir was a violent extremist, an agent of Iran, you know, all these things that simply don't have evidence. I mean, certainly Sheikh Namir al-Namir was not a classical liberal, but there's really no evidence that he was calling for, you know, terrorist attacks and this violent revolution as these Saudi paid pundits are claiming.
Barzi, before we go to break, how do you think these efforts are influencing media coverage?
See, that's the thing. I think that, like, the all those millions spent, and you know, Lee is great for identifying them, they don't have a great impact. I mean, Saudi has a terrible image in the U.S. and in the West. And, you know, the headlines, I was stunned, actually, to see how much, despite Iran's terrible image in the U.S., how many people were basically like, let's stay out of this, or let them fight it out, or don't take sides, or even, like, overtly saying, you know, let's side with Iran versus let's side with Saudi, which has been an ally of the U.S. for like 70 years. And if I was a Saudi royal looking at these numbers, looking at the headlines, looking at the editorials and the op-eds, in major outlets of influence across the West, I'd be really worried, and I would maybe consider firing Corvus for doing a pretty bad job despite the money that they're getting.
Borzu, we're going to take a quick break. Can you stick around for a few more minutes? We're getting a few calls on this.
Sure.
Okay, great. Borzu Dargahi is Middle East correspondent for BuzzFeed News based in Istanbul, and Li Feng is an investigative reporter at The Intercept. We'll spend a few more minutes on Saudi Arabia and Iran. We'll also talk about the U.S.-Saudi relationship, and then we will talk about money and politics. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
You're listening to Your Call on KALW, local public radio. To take part in today's conversation, call 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK, toll free. Let us know if you're a first-time caller. We always like to hear from new voices. And if you prefer to write rather than call, you can email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment at yourcallradio.org.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up on Monday, we'll have a conversation about the benefits of nature on our mental health. Research shows that spending time outside enhances our mental and our physical well-being, but only 10% of teens and just 5% of adults spend time outside. Why is that? What can we do to get more people outdoors? Maybe you can spend some time outdoors over the weekend. And then we're also putting shows together next week about the methane gas leak in Southern California. Environmental activist Aaron Brockovich says it's the worst environmental disaster since the BP oil spill, and we'll look at President Obama's foreign policy and the rise of right-wing extremists. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today it is our media roundtable. We're talking about coverage of the executions in Saudi Arabia last Saturday. 47 people were executed. And we're talking about what is happening between Iran and Saudi Arabia. After the executions, protesters ransacked Saudi embassies in Tehran. Saudi Arabia has severed all diplomatic and commercial ties with Iran. And we're talking about this with Borzu Dargahi, Middle East correspondent with BuzzFeed News, and Li Feng, an investigative reporter with The Intercept. And let's hear from Ali in San Francisco. Hi, Ali. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for taking my call. I had two comments to make regarding media. Right a week before the execution, there was an arms deal that was signed by U.S. and Saudi Arabia for $1.3 billion. And it was like armed companies and U.S. manufacturers supplying arms to the Saudis. It never got any coverage at all, and it happened right before a week of the execution. And the other thing I wanted to mention is just if you look in the past as far as the Saudis and the U.S. relations is concerned, for the past 50 years, the Saudis have been supporting covertly and overtly ideological and military support for Wahhabism, and that's the roots of all the extreme Islam. In the past 30 or 40 years, if you trace the root back, it goes to Saudi Arabia. And the United States, you know, punishes other countries for what all this extremism happening. A poison case is H.R. 158, where the Iranians were excluded from the visa waiver program, but they had nothing to do with any of these terrorist activities. And the roots were Saudi Arabia, and they never mentioned in that. That was my comment, and I appreciate your coverage.
Okay, thank you so much. We are actually planning to do a show about Saudi Arabia and the relationship with the U.S. because it deserves an entire show. But just quickly, Borzu, any thoughts on this and how, for example, the latest arms deal has been covered between Saudi Arabia and the United States?
Well, I mean, this stuff gets covered in the military trade journals and so on, Defense News Daily and so on. But, yeah, I haven't seen, you know, huge coverage of this in the mainstream Western press. You know, it seems like that this has become such a normal thing for Western countries, including the U.K., including France, to sell the latest weaponry to Saudi Arabia and other Gulf states, that it is no longer a big story when it happens.
And then also just the U.S. Oh, Lee, you want to jump in there?
Oh, just to quickly add, I mean, it's astounding how Saudi Arabia has leveraged its relationships with these defense contractors, which have in turn huge political power in the United States. When King Salman came to visit Washington, D.C. this fall, I mean, at his table at the Ritz-Carlton was Marilyn Houston, the CEO of Lockheed Martin. I mean, when they're going around meetings in D.C., as I understand it, I did a piece on this, they've closely nurtured these relationships, in part because they understand that defense contractors have incredible power in Congress and with this administration.
Borzu, final thoughts just in terms of how the United States reacted to these executions. The administration urged restraint, didn't really say much other than we're concerned about this.
Well, I mean, you know, executions happen all the time. I'm not downplaying what happened. You know, I mean, executions happen all the time in Saudi Arabia. And from a U.S. point of view, you know, Saudi Arabia is a cesspool of human rights. But, you know, Iran has no leg to stand on either. It's maybe the one of two countries that has more executions in the world than Saudi Arabia does. So they're not exactly a paragon of human rights either. And as far as the death penalty is concerned, hey, isn't the U.S. one of the few countries in the world left that still continues to apply the death penalty?
Right.
So I don't know. I mean, I think it would be a little hypocritical of the U.S. to make a huge stink about this guy being executed. On the other hand, I see it as a vital U.S. interest for Iran and Saudi Arabia to remain at a sort of stable level and not go to war with each other, not intensify their various proxy conflicts in Yemen, in Syria, not to push Lebanon into war, not to aggravate the already tense situation in Baghdad and Iraq. So I see the calls for restraint, calls for calm, the calls that John Kerry made to the Iranian foreign minister, and that the communications between the U.S. and the Saudi Arabia that we're not privy to, I think that was probably pretty wise to try to just lower the temperature.
Hmm. Well, very good points about Iran and the United States still using the death penalty. Borzu Dargahi is a Middle East correspondent for BuzzFeed News based in Istanbul, Turkey. Borzu, thanks again for joining us.
My pleasure.
Thank you. And we will definitely do a show in the coming weeks about the Saudi-U.S. relationship. Sticking with us for the rest of the hour is Lee Fang, an investigative reporter at The Intercept. And now I would like to welcome Michael Beckel to the show. Michael is a reporter with the Center for Public Integrity, where he focuses on the influence of money in politics. Hi, Michael. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Thanks for having me this morning.
It's great to have you. So, here we are in January. We've got 11 months to the election, and the Center for Public Integrity does such great work in terms of following the money. And you have a really good graphic on your website, Election 2016 by the Numbers. You report that the estimated amount of money politicians and political groups will raise this year is a whopping $7.5 billion.
That's right. The elections that are coming up in November will be the priciest in modern history. And for more than a year now, candidates have been crisscrossing the country, raising money. And in Iowa, New Hampshire, South Carolina, and Nevada next month, some of the votes are going to be starting to be cast. But at the end of the day, modern campaigns are expensive and more than ever relying on private money to be able to fuel those costs.
The New York Times had a great piece a couple of months ago looking at the 158 families who provided nearly half of the early money raised in the White House. Most of it for Republicans, million-dollar contributions to Hillary Clinton, zero to Bernie Sanders. And we've done a lot of shows about dark money and just how hard it is to follow the money. What does it look like this year?
This year, these outside groups that are not directly controlled or authorized by the candidates are playing a larger role than ever before. Super PACs and dark money groups that are allowed to receive unlimited amounts of money are really driving the advertising wars, especially on the Republican side. These are groups that can receive pretty much any dollar amount from almost any donor, and Republicans have been quick to utilize them. About 7 of every 10 ads that have been aired in the GOP presidential primary so far have been sponsored by these outside groups. And the super PACs, of course, do disclose their donors to the Federal Election Commission, and that's why we know many of the millionaires and billionaires who are funding these groups. But some of these other politically active nonprofit groups, they don't have to generally disclose anything about who's funding them. So whether it's wealthy individuals or companies, it is very difficult to follow the money.
And Lee, you have extensively covered this. Media outlets are going to make a lot of money this year.
Yeah, that's kind of the flip side to this. You know, the kind of arbiters of what we actually know about the election, the media, have skin in the game. They benefit from this. You know, it's incredible that Bloomberg and other media outlets actually have covered this. But, you know, there are these tiny TV stations in Iowa and New Hampshire and some of these other states that kind of benefit from our kind of strange primary schedule that lose money or perform very poorly on a regular basis, but then quadruple, I mean, if not more next year in terms of revenue because of so much super PAC and dark money and candidate spending. You look at the publicly traded companies that own TV stations, radio stations, billboards. They're telling their investors, we did a couple stories this year, we are so excited for next year. This is the CEO, this is probably the best quote to describe this. The CEO of CBS, Les Moonves, said, "Super PACs may be bad for America, but they're good for CBS." And I think that tells you everything.
Well, I loved this piece you wrote, Lee, because you quoted Moonves. He said, "The more money they spend, the better it is for us. Go, Donald. Keep getting out there."
Yeah. You know, so, you know, there's this kind of perception that the liberal media elite, whatever that is obsessed with tone. You know, they might be bad on economics. They don't care about poor people or unions, but they don't want kind of garish, you know, mudslinging in politics. Oh, come on. Look at this. The folks that own these media companies, that own these advertising companies, they want more sleaze. The more sleaze and nasty and negative advertisements that are run, that means more eyeballs, more money flowing into their pockets.
Lee Feng is an investigative reporter with The Intercept. He follows money in politics. And Michael Beckel is a reporter with the Center for Public Integrity, where he focuses on the influence of money in politics. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. $7.5 billion is the amount of money that politicians and political groups are expected to raise this election season. Who do you go to when you want to find out where this money is being spent, how it's being spent, what kind of influence does this have on the media that are covering these candidates? 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And if you've seen any of these TV ads, what really strikes you? What really strikes you so far, Michael, about the money that's been spent so far? You report that the percentage of TV ads aired so far in the GOP primary sponsored by super PACs and other outside groups, 80%. And on the Democratic side, it's 99%. I'm sorry, on the Democratic side, it's sponsored by the candidate's own campaigns. So that's a big difference.
Exactly. There's almost two different elections going on right now. The Democrats are primarily running their own advertising operations from their own campaigns. When any candidate wants to go out and run for office, they are limited in how much money they can ask for. So the maximum number of donations is infinite, but you can only ask for $2,700 at a maximum per person per election. And so the primary is one election and the general election is one election. And both Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders have raised vast amounts of money and have very well-funded campaign war chests, and they've been in the driver's seat when it comes to campaign ads and how they are choosing to deploy those resources. If you look onto the Republican side, it's a completely different story. The groups that can raise unlimited amounts of money are really in the driver's seat, and some of the candidates are relying on these outside allies in a really striking way, being able to have these groups do everything from run TV ads to help with events and signing up volunteers on the ground in New Hampshire and Iowa. But if you look at some of the leading candidates, especially For instance, Governor Chris Christie of New Jersey, his campaign has seen a surge recently, and for every single campaign ad he's run, his supportive super PAC has actually run 9 so far, and no other candidate is more striking than former Florida Governor Jeb Bush. For every campaign ad that his own campaign has funded, his supportive super PAC has run 27. The pro-Jeb Bush Right to Rise USA super PAC has already spent more than $50 million so far. And, you know, these are candidates who are competing for a lot of the same voters in New Hampshire and some of the other early states, and they're relying on super PACs to help boost their image or tear into their opponents.
Lee?
I want to ask Michael a question. You know, there's kind of this, I mean, technically, these are separate groups. They have no connection on paper to the candidates. But look, you've reported, I know other folks have too, that these super PACs and these dark money groups, they share consultants with the candidates. They do events with the candidates. There is basically lots of evidence of what looks like coordination. Do you think that the DOJ will hand down an indictment this year? I mean, do you think the FBI is looking into this? I mean, I haven't seen really any enforcement of the law except for one tiny little case from a fly-by-night character in Virginia. I mean, we all know that the FEC is broken, that the Federal Elections Commission will do nothing because it's deadlocked, 3-3 commissioners. But will the DOJ or FBI do anything this year?
Well, I think that's a great question, and it's a question on a lot of people's minds. At the end of the day, the Federal Election Commission and the Department of Justice are sort of the two cops on the beat when it comes to campaign finance violations. And as we mentioned, the Federal Election Commission, even when it's working, is a very slow process, and it's gridlocked between 3 Democratic appointees and 3 Republican appointees who often have very different ideological perspectives on what it means to be a violation. And there was just a small fine that was handed down in December regarding a case that happened 4 years ago. So even when any type of enforcement action comes through with the Federal Election Commission, it's often years after the fact. And I think any campaign that's out there has serious lawyers on the payrolls to make sure that they are at least on the following the letters of the law. I think when a lot of folks think of coordination, they don't get into the nitty-gritty legalese in the same way that the lawyers do. And so there's a lot that can be done for these groups to work hand in glove with the candidates without technically violating any of the letter of the law. That's why you have candidates appearing at fundraising functions for super PACs. That's why you have candidates and super PACs showing up at some of the same events in New Hampshire or Iowa, and the super PAC can run so much of the show is that some of the regulations are incredibly loose. And if the violation were so egregious that the Department of Justice feels it can build a case, it could go forward. But the only recent prosecution of that was, as we mentioned, a gentleman in Virginia who was literally running a congressional campaign and a super PAC supporting that congressional candidate at the same time. And to make matters worse, he was also getting kickbacks from some of the vendors, and there were questions about where that money was actually going, and that's one of the things that landed him in hot water. But if you've got a good legal team that keeps you out of the limelight, it might be very difficult for the DOJ to find a case to proceed with.
Well, my question is also just like in terms of priority. I mean, look how this DOJ treats terrorism cases or, insider trading cases. They get informants and put them in there. You know, they set up stings and they find fraud. I mean, it just seems like the DOJ is sitting on its hands here, because I haven't heard of any type of prioritization of this type of prosecution. And for that Virginia guy, I mean, it looks like he got caught for the reasons you mentioned, and because his colleagues smelled a rat and ratted him out, there's no cop on the beat, it doesn't sound like we're going to get much enforcement action.
Yeah, I mean, I think the cases that are yet to be unfolding will remain to be seen, because the Department of Justice, I think, was trying to send a signal when it went after the political operative in Virginia, but at the same time, You know, there's a lot of gray area out there that these groups are trying to maximize to their own benefit.
What do you think we can expect from the media this year? Because, you know, they're all the PBS NewsHour has roundtable discussions about the election on a regular basis. And it's just, you know, Rubio is hitting Bush, is hitting Trump. And I mean, there's hardly much substance, especially when it comes to money and politics. Michael, what are your thoughts? I mean, are you invited onto these shows to expose this information?
Well, I think there's a hunger for a lot of information about policy, and on the Democratic side of the aisle in particular, each of the major candidates have put out a very detailed campaign finance reform proposal. You have talk of introducing public financing, talk of more stringent regulations, or some of the ways to get to this coordination issue that we've been talking about. But on the Republican side, it's a different story. Senator Ted Cruz of Texas, for instance, his biggest campaign finance reform proposal would be to eliminate campaign contribution limits to candidates altogether. And, you know, you see a very different approach. And there's been organizing and some activists trying to push for the media and the Republican debate sponsors in particular to ask more questions about these issues of who's really funding the campaign. And the only time it's really been in the debate has when Donald Trump has brought it up himself as somebody who is making a case that he has seen what it looks like in the belly of the beast, and now he's going to expose that to the world. And that rhetoric has resonated with a lot of people. So even as he's made claims that he is self-funding his campaign and not going to be reliant on any big money donors, he's raising millions of dollars from individuals who are willing to give $10, $20, $100, $200 a pop, you know, who have almost given him $4 million and counting so far. So about 60%, two-thirds even, of the money that he's raised has come from people other than Donald Trump. And he is clearly striking a vein with some of that rhetoric.
And Lee, what about the various groups that have been formed by executives and lobbyists? You wrote about one, Americans for Peace, Prosperity, and Security. It was started by Mike Rogers, former House Intelligence Committee chair, who retired from Congress last year. It was also formed by current and former officials from Raytheon, BAE Systems, and other major defense contractors. And you report that Ben Carson, Lindsey Graham, Mike Huckabee, Jeb Bush, Marco Rubio, they've all spoken to these executives. And yet I've never heard of this group.
Yeah, and you know, reporters attend these events and report on the comments that the candidates make at these events without doing any stories I've seen, even though I think there's been over 20 or 30 of these events, at the actual group coordinating it. So APPS, Americans for Peace, Prosperity, and Security, was launched last year saying that they want to push the candidates, the Republicans basically, to support a strong national security platform, which is a euphemism for more military spending and more intervention overseas. So they've hosted these events with military contractors. Often they'll hire a local reporter or a local activist to actually ask the questions. But these are, you know, events set up by defense contractors and funded by these defense contracting executives to then quiz the candidates on where they stand on ISIS, on intervention, on military spending, and basically get them on the record, actually, in the words of Mike Rogers, on these issues. So this is kind of like soft influence that is not the kind of super PAC dark money spending that you see, you know, paying for organizers or, you know, on TV or radio ads. This is kind of the soft influence that happens in many election cycles, but has really ramped up in the last couple of election cycles. We've seen, like, you know, coal groups and ethanol groups basically funding organizers to go and ask candidates questions to get them on the record on these issues. But this is really a new effort by the defense contracting industry that hasn't received much attention.
And these guys are talking about what they want them to talk about. The long-haul war on ISIS, for example. You quoted Jeb Bush saying that same comment from Marco Rubio, who said the U.S. should engage ISIS as it had against the Taliban in Afghanistan.
Yeah, you know, Mike Rogers a couple weeks ago sent an email saying, you know, we launched this group in the last year to support a strong national defense. And then here's basically a laundry list of candidates on the record supporting what we want. So they're basically bragging and saying, you know, we've done a good job.
And Michael, are when you go to press conferences, for example, if you go to New Hampshire or Iowa, the candidates are doing so many town halls, and they're also doing Q&As with reporters. Are reporters asking about money in politics and also military spending?
Well, I think some are and some aren't. Some news cycles are dominated by whatever latest thing Donald Trump said, and other times you've got people who are really digging into their own entrepreneurial stories. I think on the ground, especially in these early states, as we mentioned, there's organizing going on a lot by these special interest groups that want to organize local people, because those local people will be able to have just as much access or more to a candidate than the citizens who live other places in the country, and they're able to press somebody on an issue. Just in the last few days, Senator Ted Cruz in Texas had a number of interactions with people supporting the ethanol industry on the ground in Iowa. So every issue group is trying to have people on the ground advance their issues and press the candidate when they can, because in these early states like Iowa and New Hampshire, the candidates have to spend a lot of time there to win over voters.
Michael Beckel is a reporter with the Center for Public Integrity, where he focuses on the influence of money in politics. And Lee Fang is an investigative reporter at The Intercept. And you can find their reporting at yourcallradio.org. Michael and Lee, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation about the benefits of nature on our mental health. Research shows that spending time in nature enhances our mental and physical well-being, but only about 10% of teens and just 5% of adults spend time outside. So what's being done to get more people outdoors, and how often do you spend time in nature? Join the conversation on the next Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produces the show. Malihe Razazan is senior producer. Matt Martin is executive producer. And Rosalie Atkinson is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Debbie Kennedy is our studio engineer. Our theme music is performed and composed by Live Human. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.
I'm Maria Hinojosa. This week on Latino USA, Shereen Moraga talks about being a Chicana feminist, then and now.
But what I feel, you know, is that I look at young people, and those ideas that we had as young radical women of color, you know, are actually more needed now than ever.
That's this week on Latino USA.
If Homeland Security has its way, soon residents of some states might need a form of ID other than a driver's license to get on a plane. That is, unless those states make changes.
If you start turning away people at airports because their state legislature has a different policy on driver's licenses than the federal government wants, you'd see bedlam in the country.
The issue of real IDs later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered today at 3, Latino USA at 1 o'clock this afternoon, here on 91.7 KALW San Francisco, local public radio. The time is 11 o'clock. Inflection Point is next.